Welcome to the Fremantle Press Podcast. My name is Rebecca Higgy, and today's episode, we're talking crime. I'm joined by crime novelist Dave Warner to talk about his fifth book, Over My Dead Body, as well as the newcomer on the block, Alexander Thorpe, to discuss his historical, cozy crime debut, Death Leaves the Station. Join us as we travel from WA Outback in 1927 all the way to the mean streets of New York in 2020. We'll be sharing the journey with a nameless friar, a corpse gone missing, a scientist who brings hamsters back from the dead, and none other than Sherlock Holmes. So settle in and let me introduce my guests. First, we have Alexander Thorpe. Alexander has written advertising copy for pool cleaners and concrete supply companies, taught English in Joseph Stalin's hometown, and almost managed to read half of James Joyce's Ulysses twice. He has written for news outlets, travel journals, marketing companies, and educational providers. Death Leaves the Station is his first novel. Welcome, Alexander.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Now, a runaway friar, a teenage girl, and a missing corpse, all in 1920s WA. So tell us more about Death Leaves the Station.
Alrighty. So obviously this is not a time that I was present for, 1920s. I'm not that well preserved. So basically I've always read cozy crime. I just think it's an amazing genre and it has really great, really great bones, I suppose, that structure. And I was inspired after I helped my grandpa type out his memoirs. I was listening, not so much the story, his life wasn't that interesting and he didn't kill anyone to my knowledge, but the actual sort of stories about where he grew up and that landscape, I was really intrigued by Australia in the 1920s because I had this idea of it being very dry and very sparse and very monocultural as well. But, he was telling me about the old Chinese guy who taught him how to catch crayfish and we had a lot of Catholic, this is where I got the friar from, a lot of itinerant sort of religious figures moving around. And there was just so much going on that I was like, oh, this would be a great place to transplant that, really British idea of like the country house crime. And I thought, give it a shot.
Yeah, wonderful. Now I'd like to introduce my second guest, Dave Warner. Dave is an author, musician and screenwriter. His first novel, City of Light, won the WA Premier's Book Award for Fiction and Before It Breaks won the Ned Kelly Award for Best Australian Crime Fiction and has since been published internationally. Dave first came to national prominence with his gold album Mugs Game and his band Dave Warner's From the Suburbs. He has been named a WA State Living Treasure and has been inducted into the WAMI Rock and Roll of Renown. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rebecca. Yeah.
All right. Now, Sherlock Holmes is such an iconic figure in literature. How did you approach bringing such a familiar character into the 21st century for Over My Dead Body?
Well, look, I have to go back a little way and say the inception of this idea was back around about 2000, and I had a mystery detective, Lizard Zirk, and Lizard was a guitarist, set in contemporary times, and I always thought of him as a Sherlock Holmes figure, and he had a female assistant, Fleur, and so I had this idea. I was thinking I'd done three novels on Lizard Zirk. And the idea was he played a Stratocaster instead of a Stradivarius. And I thought, maybe I'll do a movie because I'd always thought it would be a good kind of one of those television things, those hour TV things that are fun, the male and female team. And so I started writing this thing out and I said, oh, look, they're like a current day Sherlock Holmes and Watson. And then I went, oh, well, that's a great idea. Why don't I just have a female Watson in present day, and I spent a number of years trying to get that up as a film or TV series, and I took it over to the States a couple of times, and then but my idea was then the next thing, just as I'd really decided to concentrate on it, out came a TV series with a female Watson set in New York in 2020. But so I was really depressed and crushed, and this is a common thing for Australian writers because it's if you have a high concept idea, it's really difficult to get that up on film or television in Australia compared to, say, Los Angeles. But eventually I said, oh, no, bugger it, this is a good idea, because the difference with my book was that I had this idea that Sherlock Holmes could be frozen solid from 1891 and the original Conan Doyle stories. Sherlock Holmes plunged to his death wrestling Moriarty on a cliff over the Reichenbach Falls. And it was only because of public outcry that Conan Doyle, you know, revived Holmes. And so I thought, well, what if — I love what ifs in my stories — I thought, what if Holmes and Watson were real people? What if Conan Doyle was a conduit for Watson to feed real stories out, but no one actually realised they were real people? And what if Holmes had seemingly plunged to his death, but had his being able to put himself into trance, of course, which Sherlock Holmes can do, when he hit the water, he was completely frozen like a woolly mammoth. No damage to his internal organs. So all it would take then would be somebody who had the ability of some kind of cryogenics and gases to bring him back to life. And that was the whole premise, was that Georgette Watson, the great-great-granddaughter of Watson, finds his old journals, finds Sherlock Holmes, brings him back, and as it turns out, she has a father who's a cop in the NYPD, and so she often consults for them on time of death with things like drownings, etc. So she's brought into the fray, and of course, once Holmes is revived, we have what I was after in the first place, which was Sherlock Holmes stalks the streets again in 2020 with Watson.
Yeah, when I read your author note about the whole process, I was also crushed for you, because I was like, he came up with this idea before anyone else, and it's become such a popular thing now. We've got so many revamped Sherlock Holmes, but I do think the way that you've written it is so different to all these new reboots.
Yeah, well, I hope so, Rebecca, and I really do, and I'm already champing at the bit for Alexander's story there too, because, 1920s Perth, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to that too.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn to you now, Alexander, and talk about some of your characters. The friar in your book has abandoned his name, and I find nameless main characters very intriguing. So why did you choose not to give your friar a name?
Do you know, you're actually the first person who's asked me this? I've been speaking about this book so much, and I've talked about this character a lot, and no one's ever actually asked me why I did this, and I don't know. I think, I doing some soul searching, I think that it is, to be honest, it's a little bit of a lazy shorthand to make someone more mysterious. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the less you know about someone, the more mysterious they are. Obviously, not having a name, a name tells a lot about someone. But I think I may have just stolen this idea from Doctor Who. I've always been a big Doctor Who fan. Tom Baker's my favourite, the Fourth Doctor. Absolutely the best. But, you always get this when he runs into a new situation. Runs into a new situation, you get that kind of throwing off balance of everyone when they say, who are you? And the doctor says, I'm the doctor. And they say, well, what do you mean? What's your name? And is that a title? Is that a whatever? And so I thought that would be a really interesting way to sort of start the story moving, is just to throw in this character where he comes out of nowhere, first of all. He pops up in the middle of nowhere in the story. He's kind of wandering from place to place as an itinerant, like begging religious figure, I suppose, and the fact that he doesn't have a name just really puts everyone on the back foot, which I thought was a fun way to start the plot, I suppose, kickstart everything.
Yeah. Now, Dave, like our friar and so many other characters in Alexander's book, your characters are haunted by their past. I wonder, is the past always present in crime fiction?
Look, not always, but it commonly is, and especially in things like Nordic noir, it's very often revenge plots, or plots that have happened in the past. And so it tends to have become the predominant, tool that people have used. And in my case, where you've got somebody who is, you're reviving Sherlock Holmes, there's no escape from it. You're going to have to delve into the past, but it is a fairly common device in crime, and one of the reasons that I admire somebody like Agatha Christie so much talking about, you know, cozy crime is that she was able to cover the whole gamut, you know, so she didn't just rely on that. But there's no doubt that the past gives you a – and I have had in a lot of my novels in the previous one, River of Salt of mine, which dealt with a guy who's a hitman from Philadelphia who ends up in Australia on the beach in the northern east coast on pristine beaches in the 1960s trying to run from his past. So it really helps you give some depth to your character. It gives them a mission in some way to try and reconstruct their lives, and that's always interesting for the reader when they're traveling with a character in a sense. And I enjoy often the thing of setting somebody up with a dark past and trying to overcome it. In this case, for Over My Dead Body, no real dark past for Watson and Holmes, but certainly a past. And I was really interested in the idea, aside from it being a neat conception for, I thought anyway, fun to have Sherlock Holmes back on the contemporary mean streets of New York. There is also the real question of how would somebody, if somebody was revived from 120 years ago, how would they fit into current society? How would they see things? How would they emotionally deal with the loss of all their friends and what had been familiar? And the great thing about Sherlock Holmes was that you imagine that he's the kind of character who is excited by this, you know, like those daring people who go off into outer space and they could perish, but they're going to be the first people on the planet. So I could imagine that he's got that. But at the same time, he has a humanity, and we don't get to see a lot of his humanity from Conan Doyle. It's generally everything's couched through Watson and Holmes remains a very cold, aloof fish most of the time. We just get glimpses of it. So it was fun actually to delve into. In the latter part of the book, I actually go into Holmes's point of view. I avoided it early because I didn't want to have too much trying to deal with him being overwhelmed by all the things that you would. So early on, it served my purpose to primarily stick with Watson's point of view and let Holmes manage to send him away with Google and a computer to catch up on 100 years of history. But later on, when you want to get into his head and when you want to feel psychologically where he's at and his emotions and his growing affection for Watson, then I thought it was a good time to travel into that space. And that was, you know, something that the past gives you.
Mm. The future is also very much present in your book. Can you tell us about how you wove kind of the speculative world of cryogenics into the book? I'm really curious, what was research and what was your own invention?
Look, it was nearly all my own invention. When I first but the answer was it's not all. When I first conceived of this idea, it was as a movie, and it was like one of those movies people might remember, like Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger and stuff. You know, you bend the kind of envelope of what's currently acceptable, and you go, well, it's kind of improbable, but it's not totally implausible. And so I started with that, and in the film world, you often don't have to explain too much. You know, there's an electrical storm and then, you know, a few things zap and bolt and next thing Frankenstein comes alive. You know, that's how it often happens. But that was the big weakness in my book. And so I in my film story. And so I thought, if I'm doing it in a novel, is there a better way to do it? And so I did look at the idea of cryonics and cryogenics and these very low temperature gases. And then the two things that were great in terms of my storytelling was that around about that 1880s, 1890s was such an incredible time for discovery, scientific discovery. And this is when Lavoisier and Dewar and these people were actually starting to, for the first time, play around with these gases that could freeze people and that you could then bring things back to life. So that gave me an aspect to say, well, there's some kind of scientific background around this and people were thinking of these things at the time. And then when I actually started to look up people who drowned or been frozen and come to life, I was really surprised at the length of time that some people had been supposedly dead and then you know, had come alive. So I thought, look, it's not that big a stretch to have somebody who is seemingly dead for hours who comes, you're seemingly frozen and dead for hours who comes alive, and having people who are in comas for years who can then snap out of it. So as long as I felt as long as I could kind of say, well, look, let's assume that his body wasn't completely smashed up and that there was no deterioration in the in the body and in the flesh and in the organs, and we can conceive that it's possible. And as long as we can conceive that it's possible, I think it's fair game.
I do like that. If we can conceive that it's possible, it's, you know, it's ripe for fiction.
I've always found
lots of the stuff now would be like that.
I've always been impressed by writers who can just say, I think someone was always used to compare H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. And I honestly can't remember which way it goes around, which makes this not a very good story. But one of them, you know, will work in all of these chapters explaining why something's possible, you know, and go, you know, there is precedent for this, and there is the possibility. And the other one will just go, all right, so there's a flying house, right? Moving on. And I've always envied that. I've always gone, oh, I wish, you know, it feels so brave and so difficult to just go, look, this exists, it happens. Okay, moving past that.
But they're great examples. And in fact, I did, one of my ideas with Holmes when he came, I realized in the 20th century, his first assumption is that H.G. Wells has got his time machine to work.
Mm.
And that, so he's going, so where is he? Where's Wells? You know, and they say, what, Wells Fargo? No, where's H.G.? But and then I thought, oh, that's great. H.G. Wells could actually find Watson could get H.G. Wells to find the body with the submarine in the lake. And then I realized, oh no, that's Jules Verne who's got the submarine. but that is, if you think, as you're saying, then you think that you conceive of submarines and things like that that seemed so unbelievable at the time, and yet now, of course, you know they've evolved to be one of you know, the most advanced pieces of technology that we have in the world. So, anything is possible. I'm sure people will be being revived from cryogenics before long, 20 years, 50 years.
Okay. Alexander, you flag that many of your characters hold racist or sexist views in order to be true to the 1920s. How do you create that balance in representing what a character thinks without seemingly endorsing those views?
I think it's something that is difficult and that you might not always get right. I think it's one of those situations, like so many things in life, where you have to kind of resign yourself to the fact that you probably are going to get some things wrong and you'll have to, learn from that in the future. But I suppose, you know, Australia does have a racist past, and it has... in many ways, those attitudes still have, still permeate. And it's difficult to find a balance, I suppose, between whitewashing that. I think about it, you know, if I'm setting a story in the 1920s and everyone's,
best friends
high-fiving each other, going, yeah, that's great, I respect your choices. I think it will jar the readers. You know, it will jar them out of being immersed in the story because they're going, oh, well, you know, I know how my granddad talks or my, great grandparents or whatever talk, and it's not like that. But then, of course, you don't want to. I didn't feel right to me to be creating a story where people are deliberately being awful to each other and deliberately being using sort of, you know, aggressive or hateful language just because it's real. You know, I find a lot of, I do find there are a lot of films and things where people have done that and they've said, you know, look, this is the way people talk. So you have to do it because that's real. But I mean, it's not the way everyone talks. Of course, there's a huge variety of things. So yeah, there's a balance to be had there. And what I tried to do, show that those ideas did exist, but paint them as obviously not being helpful or positive. And I also tried not to, use any actual, slurs or language that's difficult because again, I like one of the reasons I love that genre of cozy crime is that it is cozy. You know, you don't like to be jolted out of your, out of your comfort zone. And it's one of the things that, you know, while I also like, you know, a lot of hard-boiled fiction and things, you don't, when you're reading an Agatha Christie book, you know, you're not expecting really vivid descriptions of a brain injury or something, you know, really gruesome anatomical stuff, because that's part of what makes that genre cozy, I suppose. But having said that, when I do read things like Wilkie Collins, like some of Arthur Conan Doyle's stuff as well, like Agatha Christie, there are, especially if you're reading the old editions, you know, there are these really homophobic, really racist things that jump out at you, and they do sort of like, oh, they sort of, you know, take you by a bit of surprise. Like, oh, I forgot. That's right. I forgot that was a thing. So yeah, I did try and to keep that in mind while I was writing, because obviously, even though it's set in 100 years ago, it's I'm writing in a time where this sort of stuff is being discussed a lot more and examined a lot more.
Yeah, I think you did that really well, especially we see sometimes one of the characters responds to seeing something quite racist and is shocked by it. And it was almost like the reader got to feel that shock, you know,
yeah,
as well.
And I had, and of course, you know, many people in that time wouldn't have been shocked by it, but I had the benefit of having characters who grew up in a quite, in an isolated setting. So they're sort of coming to society from, you know, anew, I suppose, which was very useful if you're trying to describe the past, you know, in attitudes or just in, you know, describing how things look and everything, because they can be surprised by a city, even though to us looking at Perth, I mean, look, let's be fair. Some of us look at Perth in 2020 and go, that's not a huge metropolis. But so in the 1920s, people may have done the same thing. But if you've spent your whole life on a farm in the wheat belt, then, you know, it is. It's a towering, it's a bustling metropolis. You'd be like Sherlock Holmes suddenly arriving in New York in 2020.
Well, let's return to Sherlock Holmes in 2020. Dave, how does Holmes grapple with his 19th century assumptions while trying to solve a 21st century crime?
The great thing about Sherlock is, as I said, I had the benefit of, thankfully, with Watson, I didn't have to go too much into like every little thing that he saw. The great thing about Holmes is we do know that he is such a prodigious intellect that he's very, very quickly going to work out what aeroplanes are, you know, the basics of things. So I delighted in having him confused over a few small things and things that were humorous. So, you know, he goes into the pharmacy and orders cocaine and can't get it and, you know, goes off. He's done, what are you saying?
Don't you hate that?
can't believe that it's no longer legal. But the good thing with him is because he has such a kind of a plastic and pliable brain, he's able to get his head around these things. And the other thing that via the Conan Doyle stories was that Holmes was really the first person that I know, the first detective that I know that really followed through the sorts of things that criminologists do now. So DNA, when Holmes discovers that there's DNA, he goes, oh, if only I'd have had this, there never would have been a criminal free in London, because it's a kind of like a fingerprint that a fingerprint in a much broader way. So he's actually enthused by these advances of things. But, of course, there are some things that shock him and there are some things that delight him and that amuse him, like milk in a carton is something he finds that's really interesting, you know.
I did enjoy that, something like that, seeing Holmes respond to certain things, and the scene in the pharmacy where he's just outraged was very enjoyable to read.
Yeah, good. And of course, it gives you the point too. You can say that a lot of things don't change, and it's the things that don't change too that are really interesting, that we are, you know, in so many ways, like Alexander's things, you know, we're not different in so many ways to what we might think we are, but, you know, our aspirations and the way that we go about life isn't dramatically different for most of us, you know, to what it was back then.
I did find I liked Holmes' kind of reflection on women's place in the 21st century. I actually really liked the way he thought about it. I found it quite interesting how you positioned that he was you know, very happy that equality, that women were in different, were in higher positions in society, but he didn't understand why women felt the need to be like men.
Yes, and certainly, like, I think he was worried about, like, women being police officers and things like that, where they might be, because, and his point was that he knows the darkness in the hearts
of men,
males and men, and he knows what they're capable of, and so he didn't want to lose the delight of femininity. He didn't want that to trade that. He doesn't want to trade that off for equality. He wants equality. And as I think he says, most of the great brains that I knew were women, and it always, you know, disappointed him that so many weren't given the opportunity. So he thinks that's great. Mm. But he also, as you say, he still likes, and for him being such a cold person with Watson, as he starts to find that he is romantically attracted to her, it's a completely new experience for him. And so that's certainly something that he doesn't want to lose. Mm.
I find, talking about having Sherlock Holmes being human, I suppose, in 2020, it's really interesting because, as you said before, we only hear about his, when you read the Conan Doyle stories, you only hear about what he thinks and what he does through Watson. And I actually found it quite... It was almost like a Schadenfreude in seeing him, you know, off his equilibrium, because he's always so cool and calm and collected. And I think when you're writing mystery, so often, and you're talking to people who write mystery, so often people are trying to, it's often so hard to escape from Sherlock Holmes, because he's the originator, the archetype in so many ways, that it was almost like a little bit of revenge. You know, I'm reading this and I'm always going, yes, you bastard. because it's always so hard to not, to not do things that he's done before, or to not just completely copy Sherlock Holmes when you're trying to write a mystery story, you know? So it's kind of good to see him struggle a bit.
Yeah, good.
Okay, Alexander, let's talk cozy crime. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about this intriguing subgenre and how your book fits into it?
Right. So the idea of cozy crime, as I briefly touched on before, I suppose, is that it is more focused, in my understanding anyway, is more focused on the actual, the relationships between the people, the actual puzzle itself, and less about the... less about the crime, the violence, the whatever, which is what makes it quote unquote cozy. And you have such a proliferation of these sort of stories in the early part of the 20th century, mostly from women, mostly Agatha Christie, Ngaio Marsh, Josephine Tay. You've got all of these sort of women in the early part of the 20th century writing. And what I love about it is that it does have such strong expectations. It has such a strong formula, to the point where one story by John Dixon Carr, which I think was published under a few names, but it's often called the Three Coffins Mystery. There's actually a bit where the guy who is the detective in that story, Gideon Fell, he kind of has a little monologue about what makes a good, like, a locked room mystery and what makes it work. And so, like, it was such, even, you know, back in the day, it was such a well established and such a well kind of defined genre that people were working in these kind of like nods and winks about, like, oh, okay, here we know what happens. You know, there's all of the evidence is gathered, and then, you know, at the end you have all of the people, all of the suspects are in the room together, and your detective is expounding, you know, probably standing in front of a fireplace and going, and you thought that you were there. And so yeah, I suppose the things that I really enjoyed about it were just that it has such a such a strong blueprint, I suppose, to work with a story within, and that there's a lot of room to have fun with that. You know, that when you know what people are expecting, then there's a lot that you can do to throw them off, or to sort of, you know, subvert expectations, or to sort of, yeah, even just have some fun, sort of like nod and a wink to the, I know you're expecting this. Sort of thing. Like, yeah, it's enjoyable.
So how do you think you subverted that blueprint? I'm curious.
I can't tell you. Well, I suppose obviously especially with Agatha Christie's and a lot of the similar era things, it was very very green and very British. So again, that idea of putting it, you know, not quite in the desert, but in the outback, you know, getting close to the outback there, is a subversion in itself. But also a lot of them are very set in one place, you know, like often they're in a big mansion in a country house or whatever, and they sort of spend a lot of time, the details of how people, you know, get into and out of rooms and how things are situated. You often find a sort of, even a little floor plan at the start that shows, you know, the scullery is backs onto the drawing room or whatever. Yeah. So I found that what I did in my story, you know, it starts in the middle of it starts with a body appearing in a field, in a paddock, basically in the wheat belt. And then it goes to, you know, to the coast, and then it goes on a train, and then you end up down in Fremantle. It's sort of spread out all over the place. So that's one of the things that I sort of consciously did to kind of mess with it a little bit.
I think also you subverted it through the fact that there's the violence is only perpetrated against men. So was this a conscious decision not to have any violence towards women?
It was a conscious decision to think about, yeah, definitely to think about how those traditional roles are represented. But I think that the idea of the violence being mostly against women didn't really happen that much in the era I'm talking about. So again, if I go back to Ngaio Marsh and Josephine Tay and so on, it's often sort of like, you know, an old colonel or a peer or something like that. You often get sort of an old man who's killed as well. But again, that's one of the things that I like about the genre, is that it's not always, it isn't always so focused on those, you know, your standard kind of robbery, you know, rapes and murders and just kind of like all the stuff that really happens, of course, but you don't really want to think about that necessarily if you are looking for escapism, you know? Mm. I mean, of course, sometimes you do, and that's where you get hard-boiled fiction, and that's where you get so much of the later crime, which I also really enjoy. But yeah, in this genre in particular, I think that that was one of the interesting things about it. I could be wrong at this, but I'm pretty sure I remember hearing that it was one of the first times that women were really dominating a genre as well. You know, and people call Agatha Christie the queen of crime, but so many of the other people writing at the same time were women. So I think that did create a lot of changes in the way people were represented and the way the crime was actually shown there. But yeah, when I was writing it, I did want to create characters that weren't just victims, whether they were, you know, whatever gender or age or sort of type of person they were. I didn't want people to be helpless and you know, crushed by the world. I wanted people who were actually actively pursuing the answers to mysteries and trying to figure out what was happening in a proactive way.
Now you've both already named quite a few writers, so I would love to know from both of you, who do you think is the master of plotting crime novels? Dave, I want to start with you on this one.
Well, I think, as Alexander was saying, with plot, I think the cozy crimes, the whodunit mysteries, that's generally where plot is the major part of the story. I was just doing a masterclass on this a while ago, talking about the sort of things that Alexander was talking about there. And I have no doubt that in that, Agatha Christie is still head and shoulders above anybody else who's ever sat down at a typewriter or a computer. And it's in her conception of the key to the crime. I'm pretty sure I reckon that the way she wrote the story was she came up with the what if kernel of the crime, not all her stories, but the great ones. And she's just, you know, covering that, you know, what if it's not one person who killed someone, but all the people are suspects of the killer, like Murder on the Orient Express? What if it's the person who's actually telling us the story who's the killer? What if somebody killed three people in order to kill one and two others just to throw us off the scent. She's a mile ahead of anybody else, and virtually everybody is still, doesn't matter, Scando Noir, in that kind of style. You know, she's already been there. She's already done it. In terms of the other style, I love in the vast, what I call the kind of mystery and odyssey stories, I really like James Ellroy, where you have huge stories that seemingly are disjointed but come together, and the character worked his way through an odyssey. So I find him really great there. Elmore Leonard I love for humour, fun and dialogue. And his plots are great too, because they're often multi-stranded and you have a bunch of characters who then come together in all pursuing their own goals, individual goals, and somehow or other they all end up in the same climax, which I reckon is great. And I really love Henning Mankell for his ability to plot a story, but at the same time where we travel with that word I'm using a fair bit today, but humanity, the humanity of particularly the detective and the person who we're with, which is generally Wallander or whoever his main character is for that book. So I love the way that he manages to do that, and psychologically he can go lots of ways too. So look, there's many brilliant ones, but they're all my they're the ones that I kind of bow down before the altar of. You know?
What about you, Alexander?
For me, I mean, every time I talk to anyone, including on previous podcasts, so everyone's probably sick of this. I bring up Josephine Tay. I just think that. And I'm going to keep doing that till everyone I speak to has read Josephine Tay. I think that I love everything that Agatha Christie does as well. I think that just as Dave was saying, she was. I think you're probably 100% right about that. Starting from the you know, how it was done and working back. But Josephine Tay for me just got everything right in terms of the plot and also playing with the language and having fun with the actual dialogue, and just some really, really inventive and unusual takes on it. I think even from a very early point in the genre, she was going, okay, this is what we normally do. What if she's got one called The Man in the Queue, where someone's actually stabbed standing in line at a theater, like just in the middle of the street, and still it's a mystery, still somehow it was done without people seeing. So, she really liked to play around with that. And the other one, again, I mentioned before, was John Dixon Carr. I think John Dixon Carr was, he was in that sort of same sort of environment, but he was actually American. Mm. And he had, I think he focused a lot more on the actual physical puzzle of things. Like there's a lot of his stories where it's, you know, it's focused on how, you know, how did this happen? Our perception of time was actually messed with, or it's something to do with balance, or just some really, really inventive solutions, I think. So those are my two that I always come back to as being really exceptional for me anyway.
Now, before we finish today, I want to come back to you both as writers. So people always want to know, where is the writer in the book? When it comes to crime, where are you in your books? So what personal experiences, if any, does the crime novelist draw on? Alexander, I would like to start with you. I mean, you're not a murderer, I presume.
Sure.
Sure.
Legally, yeah, why not? No, I don't know. Honestly, this is, as you said, this is my first book to get published. Certainly I've been writing for a while, and I've got lots of terrible, manuscripts hidden away under couches in places of deep shame. But for me personally, I can't write without putting myself into it. I feel very exposed when people are reading what I write. I feel like they're just staring at me in the face, you know, because every one of my characters, the bad and the good, the, you know, male and female and young and old, they have some element of my, you know, my views or my fears or my whatever in them. So I don't know, perhaps that's just my personal anxiety, but I feel like every sort of element of the book is very revealing in some way about myself. But having said that, I do so much I do work really hard to try and put in, you know, to research. I spend a lot of time on Trove. I'm so grateful for Trove. The, you know, all those archives of old newspapers and things to try and weave in stories of other people or, you know, inspiration from different world events at that time as well. But to answer the question in a brief way, I'd say I'm in everything in the book.
I think I feel the same way about my book, and I've only kind of just realized, oh, people are going to read this.
Yeah.
Being published means they're going to read this and analyze it and criticize it. And I'm like, yeah. it's quite a confronting thing that I think a lot of people think, oh, a book coming out is exciting, but it's also for the writer very vulnerable.
Absolutely. And one of the things I'm grateful for in this genre is that it doesn't usually have sex scenes, because I don't know how I'd go writing a sex scene. And I'm just imagining, you know, my mum reading it and going, do you do that? What's, you know, why did you choose to put that in? And I'm going, oh God, is that not normal? What's so I'm glad to be in a good, clean, fun genre.
Yep. Dave, what about you? Where are you in your book?
Well, it probably varies from book to book and stuff, but I'm always in there somewhere. And some of the books more than others, like the previous book, A River of Salt, that I did before this, because I set that in the early 1960s, and I was a young kid. I was probably about, you know, 10 or 12 around there. And those, that era, I think you're particularly impressionable and you remember things really, really keenly from that age. So in a book like that, where I was just able to delve straight into my personal experiences and remember that around that time in the early 60s that you went to people's places, all the women made tuna mornays. That was the dish. The men were just starting around that time to get into the idea of networking, and they were all starting golf. So I brought that into my story, where I had the Philly criminal at the start. He's into golf, and then you come out to Australia in the 1960s, and the little cop in the local town, he wants to get in the golf club because that's status. And so there's those things there. And then in characters and characters' attitudes, I think it's always going to be part, you know, of the writer, and that is the fun. And, I do try and create characters who don't think anything like me, and I don't always make them the bad, nasty people. Sometimes they're the goodies. So I think all writers, like inevitably, you're going to have some part of you in there. Well, that's probably not true. There's some, I suppose, in some sorts of science fiction and other things, you can probably, you know, write just purely from imagination. But I do find that when you're writing and you strike that vein where you've got a kind of direct emotional connection, even if you can't explain to yourself what it is, you might not be able to put all the dots, but there's something about it that evokes in you a response from your, you know, from your own world experience. They're the easy parts to write, you know, that's what I find. And the hard parts to write are the ones where you're going, like Alexander was saying, oh, okay, so when did the Titanic hit the iceberg, and why didn't it sink, you know, quicker than that? And was that really the first boat on the scene? All that kind of research stuff that you sometimes have to do. That for me is where, you know, it's a slog, you know, you've got to try and get through all of that.
Yeah, I'm also curious, as someone this is your fifth book that's been published, does it get easier?
It's my 10th, actually. But
is it really?
Yeah, it's my 10th novel, but I think the fifth by Fred Madeline, yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, so 10 novels. Alexander and I are just dealing with our first one coming out. Does it ever get less scary? How does it feel with 10?
Yeah, look, it again, that varies. It can be more scary, and I think with the first one, the elements that you're talking about, oh, what are people going to say when they read it? Is anybody going to buy it? You know, are people going to hate? You know, people going to say it's complete crap? There's a great satisfaction in doing your first personal satisfaction, I think. And then after that, if it does go well, then it can be scary, because you're going, oh, well, is the next one going to work as well? You know, like the first one, oh, that did really well. What about, is the next one going to be? So there's, we're always going to have those, that's why we're writers, and we have those insecurities and neuroses and to try and do. And it, I don't think it's ever particularly easy, but just the things that maybe concern you get slightly different. And, you know, when I was doing this Over My Dead Body, I thought, one of the things I thought, if I did this as a film, you don't have to deal too much with Sherlock Holmes fans, you know, the real diehard fans. If you do it as a book, though, you know, you know that you're going to get a lot of people who are going to hate you just because you've done something different with Sherlock Holmes. So they're different types of things. And in the end, I just go, oh, well, stuff it. I think it's a good idea. I've got to do it. And you just have to wear it and, you know, hope you come through the other side.
Okay. I think that's a good message to end on. Just stuff it and do it anyway. Listeners, Dave's book, Over My Dead Body, and Alexander's Death Leaves the Station is out this October. You can find them in all good bookstores and online at fremantlepress.com.au. Dave, Alexander, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks, Alexander.
Cheers.
Okay. If you enjoyed our chat today, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. My name's Rebecca Higgy, and I've been your host today. In 2019, I won the Fogarty Literary Award, and my novel, The History of Mischief, is out now. Join me next time as we crack the case on what goes into Australia's best books.